So-called serious video games have become more and more popular and more common. You can work as a border guard. You can try to distribute foreign aid fairly. In one game, the objective is to bring peace to the Middle East. Whatever happened to Tetris? And while the graphics and music might not measure up to Halo, a lot of these serious games are free. Do you have a serious game to recommend? Do you think that educational games can be fun? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. Ian Bogost co-founded Persuasive Games in Atlanta. He designs games that deal with political and social issues for, as he puts it, persuasion, instruction, and activism. Ian Bogost joins us from Redmond, Washington. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And how do you convince people who are used to games with mutants and superheroes and shotguns to play games with, well, more serious objectives?
It's a great point. I mean, one of the things I think we're doing with these kinds of games is expanding the playership of video games and making video games a medium that is reaching a broader kind of, you know, player than just the sort of stereotype we think of. We think of the, you know, young kids playing games.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the opportunity is to grow games, but then also to take a pastime that young people and old people alike may be interested in. And extend what it's capable of doing, what it's capable of speaking about. So it's not just about space marines and blood elves, but maybe also
sure.
about you know, more socially relevant issues.
And I know that one of the analogies you draw is to movies in their infancy, seen as pure entertainment at the beginning, but eventually they began to address more serious subjects.
You know, so all media, as they evolve, grow and change, and you know, we're in this kind of, you know, infancy of video games in a certain way. Even though this is a medium that's over 30 years old, we're still learning new things and new techniques and figuring out how to express ourselves in this medium. So it's not surprising that, you know, it's taken a while, and now, you know, with games in general being so much of a part of popular culture, that they're starting to do more things, mm-hmm. you know, more than just entertainment.
Well, give us a for instance. I know that in the last presidential campaign, for example, you designed a game for the Howard Dean campaign.
It was interesting because this was the first time there had been an officially endorsed presidential campaign video game, right? And Howard Dean had a reputation, of course, for kind of doing innovative things
sure.
on the internet. But the game itself was perhaps most monumental for being an example of an officially endorsed video game. You know, when we worked on that game, it was a game largely about what the Dean campaign was about grassroots activism and about, you know, kind of how to campaign in this mm-hmm. new internet election world. And we saw people talking about that, kind of using this game as an opportunity to say both, hey, you know, I understand what the campaign is suggesting I do in my, you know, local area, but also saying, wait a minute, you know, when is Dean going to stop talking about campaigning and start talking about politics? So, you know, not only are these games kind of, you know, possible places where communication can kind of go outbound from like a political organization, but also you can watch how players are playing these and look at the kind of conversations and discussions they're having around them. I mean, we use that experience very much as an inspiration to explore public policy issues themselves in games. I think, you know, games are a real wonderful medium for looking at the connections between complicated issues. And that's really what politics is about, and it's exactly the way that we don't talk about politics in the popular media.
Well, I know, for example, in the Howard Dean game, you could convert some voters by handing out X number of flyers in a neighborhood or various other activities. And I know that afterwards you critiqued yourself, saying, wait a minute, we weren't talking about anything other than campaign organization. This wasn't about ideas, and it, you know, it could have been used for the George Bush campaign just as well as the Howard Dean campaign.
Sure, exactly. You know, and there's a funny story I tell about that game in which we were looking at online conversations. The Dean campaign had this wonderful infrastructure of blogs and online networks, people talking, right? And we were watching people talk about that very thing. And this was late December 2003, before the Iowa caucus, before the campaign really fell apart. And we took all that feedback and kind of shipped it back up to Vermont to share with the campaign. I really thought that was the most interesting thing to come out of the video game, was not how many people were playing or whether they mm-hmm. were going to vote for this candidate or that one, but they were having a discussion that the campaign really needed to hear. And of course, you know, the kind of history is now behind us, so we know that the campaign kind of never turned itself around from this meta campaign about politicking rather than about politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a, you know, a lesson for us to learn, not just about video games, but the way that video games are not just a communication tool in this case. They're also, you know, really people are interacting with ideas and with policy issues and, you know, with the real material meat and potatoes of politics through their experience playing games and then discussing them afterward.
And I know that you're not a partisan. The Democrats just called first.
Well, I mean, I have my own political stances and my own issues and my own morals. But I think one of the things that I'm really interested in games and in general is breaking down these kind of party line walls when we talk about issues. I think if you look at the way political communication takes place in this country right now, it's very much focused on partisan issues, very much focused on values issues. And in matter of fact, the issues that really affect all of our lives on a day-to-day basis are pretty mundane. They're kind of boring, right? You know, things like healthcare or education or economic development or food safety, or transportation and airport security. And all of these are things that I've made video games about, right? So, I really think that if we stop paying attention to politics and use video games instead to really focus on policy and lived experiences and social issues, that's the way that people will become more involved and more active in their political lives.
Well, describe a game, for example, another game that Oil God. What is Oil God about?
Sure. Yeah, Oil God is a small game. It's an example of a kind of game I call a news game. And Oil God was created early last fall, right when we were kind of at the peak of that summer gas prices, right, from last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to make a game that kind of explained.
Glad that's not going to happen again. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we're going to see this over and over again. We wanted to make a game that was going to explain the relationship between kind of geopolitics and global oil and the prices of gas. So in the game, you're an oil god, right? You're literally this sort of, you have this hand of God that you wield over this toy world below. And your goal in the game is to raise gas prices in a target country, and we kind of generate a little world for you to play with.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that by, kind of creating war or natural disaster, and then there's a model of the oil futures market and distribution and refining and all the things that go into, the real factors that affect oil prices and gas prices. And what I wanted to show with this game was that the kind of simultaneousness of all of these different factors coming together, geopolitical unrest in the Middle East and mm-hmm. Hurricanes Katrina and Rita last year in the U.S. and other parts of the world. These things were all coming together to create the factors that were really influencing not only the increases but also the price fluctuations in oil. So, here you see this example of this system with all these moving parts, and that's the thing that games are really kind of good at showing.
Hmm. We're talking with Ian Bogost, a founding partner of Persuasive Games and assistant professor at the School of Literature, Communication, and Culture at the Georgia Institute of Technology. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Yoama, is that correct?
Yeah, Yoana.
And you're in Boulder, Colorado. Go ahead.
I am. Thanks for taking my call. I have discovered a wonderful game. It was actually emailed to me by a fellow friend and teacher, and it's called Food Force. And it's distributed, it's available as a download on the World Food Program's website. And the idea is that you have to navigate food to fleeing refugees or to communities that are isolated and, torn up by war and so forth. And I have two boys, 12 and 10, who've played it, and they've introduced it to some of their friends as well. And they love it. I mean, it's incredible because they make it so real. You have to drop food from a helicopter
mm-hmm.
down to fleeing refugees. You have to drive a truck through an area where there are people that are, ready to take all of your food shipments and hijack it. So I think it's a very good game for kids, and it's age-appropriate from about 8 to, I would say, 13 or 14 even.
Yeah, the World Food Program, of course, part of the UN, and this is Ian Bogost, a UN-sponsored game.
Yeah, this is a great game, actually. And, what's interesting about Food Force, apart from the fact that the UN made a video game, right, which is interesting in and of itself, what I think really the most remarkable thing about Food Force is that you have in this game the idea that being a humanitarian is a career that a kid could think about having, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And, the kind of video games that we normally think of, a sports star or you're a space marine or mm-hmm. you're kind of living some fantasy life, right? And it's very escapist and, we tend to think of them as this kind of throwaway time, this leisure time. And a game like Food Force shows you that, video games don't have to always be like that. It's okay for them to do so sometimes, right? But we also have the opportunity through this medium to show, hey, here's what this job is like. This is a viable career move if you want to think about it. I think that's gonna pay off in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know my kids love it, and they're not big consumers of video games in general, but they do love this one, and I think it's a really noble game.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Joshua. Joshua with us from Reno, Nevada.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You know what? I was calling in because I've never called in before, but I'm a college student, and I found an interesting topic because I'm a hardcore gamer. Like, when Halo 2 demo was out, I spent over 140 hours in the 15 days it was released. And I recently cut my arm open, and there's a game called Trauma Center, ER. Well, when I went to the ER, I was talking with the surgeon, and I knew the name of every muscle group and tendon in my arm because of that video game. And he was actually amazed because I knew everything he had to do to clean up the wound, to repair it, and to put it all back together. And Trauma Center is available on the Wii. And, you know, it's just a game where you're a surgeon. And I must say, video games teach you a lot, and people undercredit them all the time.
And if you ever have to parachute from an aircraft at 12,000 feet, you know exactly what to do.
Exactly. Same theory.
Right. Joshua, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So long. We're talking about persuasive video games. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ian Bogos, I wanted to ask you, we've talked about games of advocacy and games of education. There are also commercial companies getting involved in this. They're trying to persuade people, too.
Yeah, sure. I think that, you know, what you're seeing in video games in general is just this expansion of this medium, right? So it's not just entertainment anymore. We're seeing, you know, we've already talked about kind of government, world mm-hmm. and national government organizations. Corporations are starting to look at video games as a way of communicating with their customers and employees. At my studio, at Persuasive Games, we've worked on both kind of advertising games, which are maybe things that the consumers out there have already encountered on the web, but also things like games that are used in corporate training, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to help help employees understand exactly, you know, how to work the business that they're working in. And, you know, when you have a kind of hands-on experience like that in a game, it's certainly, you know, much more engaging and possibly more effective than reading a manual or watching a video or something like that. You know, so you're starting to see video games kind of become a legitimate medium. They're doing multiple things, not just entertaining, also training, educating, you know, persuading, working in politics, working in kind of in kind of corporate contexts, and also, you know, sort of artistic and expressive contexts.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about next. In particular, there was a controversy over a game that somebody designed that revolved around Columbine. Explain the controversy for us and what the upshot of it was.
Yeah, so there's a game out there called Super Columbine Massacre RPG, and the name itself may put some people off, but it was, you know, it was actually intended by the creator as a kind of way of poking fun at some of the conventions of video games at the same time as he was trying to really make a kind of legitimate documentary-style game about the experience of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold during the Columbine tragedy, right? So it was controversial for a lot of reasons. One was just that it's a video game about Columbine, and that very idea is unsettling to a lot of people. I mean, we've had films, you know, like Elephant and Bowling for Columbine that have dealt with similar issues of school shootings, mm-hmm. And that seems to be, you know, okay, or at least more legitimate because film is a medium maybe we understand culturally in a better way. So that's one part of the controversy. You know, another part of the controversy was that in the game you are taking on the role of the killers, right? And this is something that a lot of people are uncomfortable with, kind of, you know, being inside of their heads. But the interesting thing is that's exactly where the power of this game comes from, sort of the unsettling nature of living this day through the eyes of these two kids. And, you know, really, if you think about what we really want to do is kind of understand these situations, try to make sense of them, try to prevent them from happening. Maybe that's exactly the sort of thing we should be doing, no matter how uncomfortable it really is. So this is a, you know, a difficult game to play. It's not a pleasant game. It's not a fun game to play. And that's something we have to learn. You know, and this is why part of this controversy is coming up. The notion of gaming Columbine, of turning it into a game, is the kind of rhetoric that you hear a lot from critics of this game or other games like it. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the key, I think, for the future of these games is not to understand them as distractions, as entertainment, as playthings that we're going to laugh at, but as a medium of expression that's trying to tell us something or show us something, especially the kind of, you know, the lives of someone that we don't normally get to encounter, whether it's the UN humanitarian or, you know, the psychopath.
interesting, same problem as with comic books, which are long since graduated from just being for kids. But nevertheless, that games and comic people, it's going to be a long time before you correct misperceptions about that. Anyway, let's see if we get one last call in. This is Nick. Nick with us from Green Bay in Wisconsin.
Hi, I play the occupation games and stuff. I just can't get into them because it takes too long to learn. I'd rather play something like Halo where you can just go around and kill people and kill things and destroy things. And I mean, I'm an older person. I'm 35, but I still, I mean, I could spend hours on there. My wife hates that game.
Nick, you're not an older person.
it's funny, though, right?
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's funny because we normally think of gamers as being, you know, really, you know, young kids, right? And
yeah,
so
exactly.
In the game industry, 35 is, you know, sort of middle-aged, and that's something that's changing, which is, I think, for the best.
But quickly, I think Nick speaks to the problem. These have to be good games as well as just having a point of view.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is a challenge for all of us who are interested in these games. Is, you know, it's not enough just to make a video game because then it will be interesting, or, you know, then it will be press-worthy, or you'll be able to kind of pique someone's interest, whether they're young or old. It's really important to understand the craft and the art of making video games. It's hard. It's very difficult. And it doesn't matter if you're making a big commercial game that's going to go into the stores or you're making a small game to distribute online.
Ian Bogost, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Ian Bogost, assistant professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His new book, Persuasive Games, will be published next month. Ira Flatow will be here tomorrow for Science Friday. We'll see you again on Monday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.